I think if everyone's sort of settled, we'll try and start. There are a few free seats here, I see, though. There were people trying to get in, but there seem to be some one or two free seats down here. I'm just waving to people in the video room. Anyway, can I say again how pleased I am so many people are coming. It's really great for me. I really appreciate it. Coming over lunchtime, I know it's quite an investment of time, so it's really nice to get this going in such a good fashion, I think. So I'm really grateful to you for coming. Could I just remind you where we got to? In the last lecture, I was discussing the appeal of primarily Marx's writings, but by extension, Marxism as a system of thought that's dominated a lot of 20th century history. And I argued that the reasons behind this appeal are not primarily its quasi-religious character, as many people have supposed. That is to say, commonly argued, as I mentioned last time, that Marxism is a kind of quasi-religion. And there are certain elements of that, plainly. But I don't think that's the main reason for its appeal. I offered two reasons last time. One was its intellectual power as a system of thought which not only helps explicate past history, but also tries to project towards the future. And I'd got some way last time through trying to analyze out some of the nature of that intellectual coherence. But second, perhaps even more important, I want to argue anyway that one of the prime reasons for the appeal of Marx's writings and of Marxism is that these embody key values of the Enlightenment, that Marx, in many respects, was a key thinker in promoting the residue of Enlightenment, where Enlightenment means, roughly speaking, that a main part of the project of modernity is to break away from the past, to break the hold of tradition and custom, and to substitute for these a rational understanding of human social life, which will allow us to control the future. You'll probably know that one of Marx's famous contemporaries, Auguste Comte, who Marx didn't like at all, Comte gave a kind of pithy version of what the Enlightenment stood for, I think, when he said, "Pouvoir pour pouvoir." You have to understand the future in order to control the future. I take it Marx was a prime figure in trying to show how an understanding of social life, indeed an understanding of ourselves, can allow us to control the future. That was what Marx was all about. That vision, as I'll be trying to say at the end of this lecture, and in a way through all of these lectures, has lapsed in the late 20th century. When you want to ask the reason why has Marxism collapsed, it's not enough just to look for some of its inherent limitations, which I'll try and discuss later in this lecture. You also, I think, have to relate this to the problem of Enlightenment in the late 20th century. We've discovered certain things about the main dynamics of modernity which don't really fit with the original guidelines, as it were, which the Enlightenment set down. This is a leading thread, really, therefore, of what I want to say through most of these lectures, because we're struggling, I think, to come to terms with the problematic residue of Enlightenment. And more about that a bit later. Now, last time I argued that in Marx's intellectual scheme, there are a couple of key things which allow Marx to try to explain social change. History is disjunctive. History as the persistent history of revolutionary transformations. Marx had two key ideas in trying to interpret historical change in this way. First of all, he argues, in any kind of class society, major type of class society, you get an increasing divergence between the existing relations of production and the emergence of a new set of forces of production. We looked at how that worked with the transformation of feudalism last time. I should stress to you that Marx's writings on the collapse of the ancient world and Marx's writings on the transformation of feudalism have been very influential among historians who are not themselves Marxists, who wouldn't have called themselves Marxists in other respects. Marx did provide a kind of schema for understanding these transformations, which has proved persuasive to many people, has many critics as well. However, to generalize this, you have to see how this works with the key kind of society which Marx was concerned with, the key transition, which is the transition from capitalism to socialism. The same scheme, if it generates that intellectual power, should work to help us understand what is happening to our society and how it prepares the way for a new one. And indeed, Marx developed a powerful account of this. Second, I tried to show last time, Marx argues there are three sequential, not necessarily temporally sequential, but structurally sequential sets of revolutions which occur when you get major processes of social change. First of all, you get economic contradictions between the relations and forces of production, which mean a new economic order is emerging from within the old one. Second, this tends to be associated at some point then with political transformation. And third, political transformation tends to be guided by ideology, by ideological change or ideological transformation. We would look for this also when we look at what's supposed to happen to the evolution of capitalism and its transformation into socialism. So let me move directly to this issue. Remember, a capitalist society, when it emerges, is based upon a competitive market economy in which there is a fundamental historical change, according to Marx, a dislocation between producer and consumer. This is the first society in which most people are in a labor market. They have to offer themselves, as we all do, on a labor market to get a living. It's also the first society where market mechanisms, rather than conscious control, intervene between production and consumption. In previous types of society, which are always localized types of society, producers produced for local needs. They knew what these needs were. There was a match between production and human need. That match is broken by the advent of capitalism. For Marx, early capitalism is fundamentally a competitive system. It depends upon many, many producers who never see their consumers and who relate to those consumers via market mechanisms. Now, Marx argued that the inherent progression of capitalism produces its own transformation in an analogous fashion to the transformation of feudalism. Of course, the content is different, but the logical form, if I can put it that way, is the same. You have an existing set of relations of production with the emergence of early competitive capitalism. You have a new set of forces of production emerging within the system, creating increasing tensions or contradictions, which in the end are due to lead to overthrow it and produce a new type of system altogether, which of course is to be socialism or communism. More on that a bit later. Let's look at what these forces are. Now, according to Marx, capitalism, from its earliest days, is a voraciously expanding system. In this, he was quite right, I think. One of the main distinguishing characteristics that separates a capitalist economy from pre-existing forms of economy, Marx argued, is that capitalism cannot stand still. It is not a system which can routinize itself. Capitalism as an economic system only works if it's constantly looking for new forms of exploitation of either labor power, raw materials, or technology. This means that capitalism is a restlessly expanding system, not just restless in its everyday changes, as we all know it is. I mean, we all live in a capitalist economy. We're all conscious of the constant technological change it involves, for example. But according to Marx, capitalism also rapidly and restlessly spreads across the world. Not only a system which is restless in terms of its inner dynamics, it's also a system which voraciously spreads across the world, gobbling up other cultures, other civilizations, other ways of life which stand in its way. Marx thought basically this was a good thing, historically progressive. Max Weber, as we'll see next time, thought it was a bad thing, at least in some of its consequences. Capitalism is an unstable system based upon market mechanisms that nobody controls and is let loose upon the world. That, in a way, for Marx, explains the issue that I mentioned in the very first lecture, the dynamism of modernity. For Marx, the intrinsic dynamic character of modernity is governed, in the last analysis, by the restless, constantly changing, expansionary nature of capitalism. I think this is quite important. I'd like to come back to it in subsequent lectures, because you have to ask what it means to live in a world which can't stand still. You have to ask what it means to live in a world where the economy does seem to depend upon constant expansion. Because obviously the world is finite. At some point, that kind of society would seem to run up against the finite nature of the world, whether it's in terms of raw materials, natural resources, ecological limits, or whatever. There would seem to be a coming crunch, as it were, which Marx certainly diagnosed, but which we seem to be stuck with without the Marxist forms of remedying it. More on that also in subsequent lectures, because it's very, very important. Anyway, for Marx, the sort of basic starting point of competitive capitalism is a restless system. It's also a system which is cyclical. Marx was one of the first economic thinkers to diagnose the fluctuating nature of a capitalist system. Capitalism tends to go through recurrent periods of boom and crisis. We all know it does. That's a key question. What period of the economic cycle the British economy is at the moment, for example, as compared with its other competitors in trying to make sense of the Conservatives' claims about economic prosperity. Capitalism is a cyclical system. Part of its inability to stay still is that it goes through recurrent periods of boom and crisis. As it does so, people get thrown out of work. They become reabsorbed into work in periods of prosperity. In other periods, millions of people are thrown out of work because there aren't enough jobs created for them. This is how capitalism starts off, Marx says, but he argues that as it develops, as it matures economically, it produces the conditions which essentially lead to its own overthrow. This is a more complex story than I have a chance to tell here, but basically it depends upon two processes that Marx thinks tend to be produced by the very erratic nature of capitalist development. And this is still on the economic level. First, you get an increasing process of what Marx called the concentration of capital. Concentration of capital. And second, process of Marx sometimes called the centralization of capital. The concentration of capital refers to the growth of large corporations, which tend to play an increasingly central role in the economy. What happens, Marx says, is that in periods of economic downturn, periods of economic crisis, larger companies tend to survive at the expense of smaller ones because they've got more resources to withstand periods of downturn, and companies tend to merge in such situations. You get a tendency, therefore, towards a concentration of capitalist enterprise with a small number of large corporations dominating the economy increasingly, not only on a national level, but on an international level as well. Later Marxist writers, not Marx himself, described this as the tendency of capitalism to produce monopoly or oligopoly. Monopoly capitalism or oligopoly capitalism is a tendential character of the system, Marx argued. It's a functional response, if you like, to its crisis character. It tends to produce a centralization, and therefore the emergence of gigantic companies like General Motors, the oil companies, and so forth, didn't really exist in Marx's time, but have become such a prominent part of 20th century history. Process of centralization of capital, second thing down the bottom here, refers to the emergence of institutions which, in response to the restless cyclical nature of capitalism, try to centralize some central controlling mechanisms under their direction. Marx had in mind central banks, particularly, other kinds of financial institutions, and the intervention of government in the economy. As the kind of cyclical nature of capitalism expands, everybody sees, in a certain sense, you have to do something about it. Banks therefore emerge, which centralize certain credit functions. Governments try to intervene to produce some stabilizing of the erratic nature of the capitalist business cycle. Now, according to Marx, you put these two processes together. On an economic level, you have essentially capitalism undermining itself, because what starts out as a system of many, many interdependent producers who have no knowledge of consumers, where market mechanisms are the only intervening phenomenon between one and the other, tends to end up as a system of much more centralized conscious control. As you move towards a system of centralized, organized capitalism, what are you doing? Well, according to Marx, what you're recognizing, and what the economy is kind of recognizing, is that capitalism is not a system which depends upon a high level of individualism. It seems to do ideologically. In fact, Marx says, a capitalist economy makes us all much more interdependent than ever before. Again, both on a national and international level. With a modern division of labor, we're all dependent upon everyone else for producing the goods and services which make our lives possible. Capitalism is therefore an intrinsically socializing system. But that social nature of capitalist production is hidden and is denied by the early formation of individualism as the basis of a competitive market economy. That market economy becomes transformed from within. Now, as this happens, Marx says, you have capitalism ready to transform itself. What do you do? Of course, you have the emergence of a more social system of production, a more collaborative system of production emerging here. Marx says this is still capitalism. And in some ways, he thought it was capitalism in its worst aspects, because where the big corporations dominated, and where they still followed capitalistic imperatives, as they have to do, Marx said, you have a system both of monopoly power and subjection to certain kinds of market forces combined with one another. But this is an economic system, Marx thought, ready to be pushed over into socialism. Because what's involved here is the reintrusion of conscious control of production in relation to consumption. Marx didn't live the era of advertising, but advertising is plainly one way in which kind of conscious direction of consumption is organized, not only by large corporations, but by many business corporations today. Marx thought the capitalist economy, by the time it gets to the phase of monopoly production, is ready to be transformed into a new type of system, to a more collaborative one of conscious and, to some extent, centralized direction. So economic revolution is already occurring. It would follow from Marx's schema that this then should translate itself into political and ideological revolution. And this is exactly what Marx thought would happen. Along with economic transformation, you get the emergence of two types of political movement within a capitalistic society, Marx thought, which set themselves up against the dominant groups. First of all, you get the emergence of the union movement. The union movement is a form of collective assertion of power on the part of those, particularly propertyless individuals, who do not have any power in early capitalist society. The worker who entered the factory gates in the early years of capitalism, of course, had no control over his or her life. Unions, Marx says, are a sort of negative response to this situation. They are a response to using worker power to recognize the collective power of labor. It's again a socializing feature, therefore, of capitalism. As this develops, Marx thought, and he looked to England as one of his main examples, partly because of living here, I suppose, you get the emergence of a political arm of the labor movement. In other words, you get the emergence of labor parties or socialist parties which represent the collective interest, Marx thought, of potentially the majority of the society. Because most people increasingly become propertyless, a socialist party can represent the collective interest as against the individualized power of capital. As these two things come together, you get a potentially revolutionary situation, the conjunction of a radicalized union movement and active socialist political parties seeking to contest all of the dominant bourgeois or industrial parties. Now, Marx famously had two theories of revolution, and it's worth me, I think, mentioning of these because they have a certain interesting historical resonance. One theory of revolution in Marx, particularly in his earlier writings, tends to associate revolution with the most advanced industrial countries. Marx thought that America and Britain would have revolutions fairly early on, and he was very disappointed in his lifetime when these revolutions didn't emerge. This, you know, the British workers didn't really live up to his image of their revolutionary fire, and I suppose you certainly say they still don't if you see them today, but certainly didn't in the 19th century. This is a theory of revolution based on the maturity of capitalism. It's the one, I think, most consistent with the scheme I'm outlining here. According to this scheme, the more socialized the forces of production become, the more the labor movement and socialist parties are able to build on this as an economic base. Towards the end of his life, when he saw that revolutions were not being generated from within the industrialized countries, Marx produced a somewhat counter theory of revolution, although it's not inconsistent with his first one. This theory of revolution suggests that revolution is most likely in those countries precisely at the periphery of capitalist production. Those countries in which capitalism has made a certain advance but are still basically agrarian countries. The reason Marx thought this was possible is that he thought this would produce a conjunction of contradictions. In a less developed society, the impact of capitalist markets could be more destructive, he thought, than it was in a more mature capitalist system. It's a kind of meeting point of the old and the new, you know, generates a sort of explosive mixture. Towards the end of his life, Marx was asked whether revolution could occur in Russia. He was asked this by Russian revolutionaries, the famous exchange of letters, and Marx said yes. Revolution can happen in Russia for the reasons I've just outlined. However, he added something very crucial. He said revolution can only happen in Russia if it spreads also to the rest of the industrialized world. In other words, he thought a revolution was possible as initiated in the capitalist periphery, but he thought it could only be a successful revolution if it became an international revolution. In other words, if the know-how, the technology, and the other forms of expertise of the more developed economies could be used to further the revolution in the less developed country. Now, everybody in this audience will recognize the historical poignancy and importance of this, because the first Marxist revolution of the 20th century did happen in Russia. Because, however, that revolution happened only in Russia. At least for a long period, it was the only society which claimed to be a socialist or Marxist society in Marx's sense. Stalin invented the doctrine, socialism in one country, to say, contrary to what Marx had seemed to say, yes, you can have a successful revolution in a backward country. Trotsky disagreed, and the dividing line between Soviet Marxism and Trotskyism has always hinged on this. According to followers of Trotsky, you must have an international revolution if it is to be successful. Trotsky wrote a series of celebrated books on the Soviet Union, such as Revolution Betrayed, claiming that this was not a true workers' state, could not have a revolution in this situation. A lot of historical consequences stem from this that we must look at in subsequent lectures, because you have to ask whether what went on in the Soviet Union, or in Russia when it became the Soviet Union, was in some sense generically or authentically in line with what Marx anticipated. Or was this the Asiatic mode of production becoming transformed into a despotic society where communism served as an equivalent to the kind of ideology that used to dominate in the traditional world, Oriental despotism, as Marx used to call it. A lot of very resonant questions here, because you know, as everyone knows, until 1989 anyway, the history of the 20th century is the history of Marxist revolution. But all of those revolutions, successful ones anyway, happened in the periphery. Or they all happened in countries which were not mature capitalist economies, but which are, whatever you want to call them, third world countries, developing countries, peripheral countries, there's no satisfactory phrase, but non-Western industrialized, non-industrialized countries are where the revolutions happened. We have to ask why and what the consequences of the situation actually were. Anyway, economic transformation is followed by political transformation. There's no doubt that Marx was right about quite a lot of this. In most Western countries, with the notable exception of the United States, you did get socialist parties which arose, probably partly as a consequence of the situations that Marx identified. The question, why is there no socialist party in America, is a question which the German thinker Werner Sombart posed. Famous book, Why Is There No Socialism in the United States? And that question was asked by political thinkers for many years into the 20th century. Now, you could say, in a way, the situation is reversed, interestingly, because in most Western countries since 1989, communist, not so much socialist parties, have changed their identity. Is the political system becoming quite the opposite of what Marx said, Americanized? That is Tony Blair's New Labour Party essentially a form of democratic party retreating for socialism? This is the question which we'll look at later on in these lectures. Third, ideological revolution goes along with political revolution. What is the ideological revolution? Well, the ideological revolution, I take it, is obvious. The ideology which supplants the capitalist system of liberal individualism, which is a stress upon the individual, the individual's rights, the individual as the sole locus of rights and obligations, is increasingly replaced by socialism or communism. Socialism and communism are recognition of the social or communal nature of capitalistic production as it becomes economically transformed into an independent system of producers. Communism and socialism are the ideological expression of the increasingly interdependent and social nature of a society which proclaimed itself at origin individualist. Such individualism does not survive, Marx thinks, or at least in certain ways becomes transformed with the advent of a socialist society. Now, Marx argued that some revolutions would be violent and some would not. He thought that all Western countries would go through a process of political and ideological revolution. He thought some could do this peacefully, particularly the UK or Britain, and Holland are two cases he mentioned. In those countries, he thought you had established parliamentary democracy. A parliamentary democracy, a socialist party, could be successful within the voting system. As it became successful, it could become the dominant party, and it could lead a process of revolutionary change from within the parliamentary order itself. I think it's quite important to note that Marx was not really interested in revolution, even though the idea is central to his writings, that is political revolution. Marx was not the kind of writer like Georges Sorel or somebody was, who actually esteemed the process of revolution. For Marx, political revolution very much puts the seal upon already established changes. By the time a socialist party gets into power, it's not so important how it gets into power, it is that it inherits an already transformed economic and ideological situation. The process of revolution is not that important for Marx. I think it's the revolution puts a kind of seal upon already established transformative processes in history. Now, what is this socialist society supposed to look like that Marx envisaged? This is, again, obviously historically very important to us, but at the same time problematic. Problematic partly because Marx quite consciously refused to say very much about the socialist society of the future. He did so consciously because he tried to separate himself from what he called utopian socialism. Marx didn't like people who drew up detailed blueprints or plans for the future society. By utopians, he meant authors who would say, well, look, this is wrong with our society. Let's change it by doing this, 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 and this. Marx didn't like that kind of thinking because he thought it wasn't grounded in history and in reality. Marx's own account, he believed, was ordered by an accurate analysis of the imminent trends within a capitalist society. It wasn't simply imposing a blueprint on history. It wasn't ethical socialism. It wasn't ethical socialism. Marx was very careful to say this. His version of socialism was not based upon a moral critique of the existing society, or certainly not fundamentally on that. It was based, he argued, much more upon diagnosing the imminent trends of history. If you go back to Hegel, these imminent trends are producing a society where human beings become more conscious of their relationship to themselves and to nature, and therefore enter, as it were, a higher phase of the organization of the human social order. Marx refused to speculate about the future order, at least in any more than a few details, because he thought this would have to be governed and determined by the people who actually inherit that order. If you try to speculate about it too much, you'd be back in the domains of utopian socialism. So for better or for worse, we only have a few comments that Marx made in various sources, like his discussion of the Paris Commune, to know what his view of the future society would be like. But we do know certain things about it. These, as with all things in Marx, are not just ideas. They became to some extent realities, as they were enshrined within orthodox communist doctrines in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. Marx identified two phases in the emergence of a socialist or a communist society. By the way, if I didn't mention this before, in Marx's time, socialism and communism were used as equivalent terms. This was a long time before communism became a kind of scare term for many people in the West. They simply had the same root, as I think I stressed before, the communal as opposed to the individual, the social, as opposed to a purely individual theory of human association. And for a long time, and in Marx's writings themselves, they used as more or less equivalent communism and socialism. They became distinguished later on in a way in which I'll mention shortly. First of all, anyway, as would logically follow, you have a transitional phase in the emergence of a socialist or communist society. After this, you have the so-called higher phase of the emergence of socialism or communism. Transitional phase, Marx argued, is the phase after a process of revolutionary change, when the party which represents the organized interest of society, in other words, the Labour or Socialist Party, sets about introducing reforms to limit the power of capital. This would not yet be a classless society, Marx thought. It would be a society with many class mechanisms still around. It would be a society in which capitalistic mechanisms still played an important part. You always have a long period of transition between two different types of society. Marx labelled this phase, and this is a notorious thing, the phase of the dictatorship of the proletariat. A phrase about which Marxists quarrelled for decades, both inside Soviet Union and outside. Well, it didn't quarrel for too long in the Soviet Union because it wasn't really allowed for too long. Dictatorship of the proletariat sounds, I think, obviously an oppressive idea. It sounds as though Marx is saying, once you get over the bourgeois stage, this will be a stage of authoritarian imposition of the rule of a minority. I think you could say that's how Lenin really did interpret it. But I think a more charitable or latter-day interpretation of Marx could, I think, produce a somewhat different version. In Marx's time, dictatorship didn't yet mean the actions of a dictator, as it later came to mean. Dictatorship tended to be a more nebulous term, referring to overall organization, dictating how things might be, as it were. Dictatorship of the proletariat, if you look at it in a charitable light, I think, could be said to be the idea of producing rule by consensus, a Rousseauian thread in Marx, if you like. Marx believed that the main reason why the society of the future would be classless is that private property would no longer play a significant role in it. Private property, or ownership of the means of production, as I mentioned before, is the basis of class in Marxian theory. This would become an eminently classless society. In a classless society, you don't need class parties, Marx thought. Bourgeois parties are class parties. They represent basically the interests of capital or the interests of labor. In a socialist society, you would hope to get a consensual party, which would represent the interests of at least the majority in the society. You could say the period of the dictatorship, the proletariat, was a phase in which that consensual political system was set into being. But we don't really know, I think, what Marx meant by it. We don't really know whether he thought it would be an authoritarian phase or not, but you could interpret it anyway a little more charitably. This phase, the so-called higher phase of the development of socialism or communism, is a very interesting one. I just want to say a few things about it because it still has some contemporary relevance, I think, contrary to what one might imagine. Two things are supposed to happen in this phase. First of all, you get the abolition of the state. Second, according to Marx, you get the abolition of the division of labor. Both of these sound like a relapse into utopian socialism, but they're not. By abolition, Marx meant essentially transformation, radical transformation. Radical transformation of the division of labor in a more mature socialist or communist society, Marx thought, would involve two things. First of all, it would involve increasing automation on the level of technology. Marx was possibly the first theorist of automation. Marx argued that the process of technological change goes something like this. You have, first of all, you have craft occupations in feudalism, of carpenter, for example, where a carpenter is a skilled worker. Even a peasant was a skilled worker, really. With capitalist technology, this is attacked, and you get what Marx calls the detailed division of labor. I noticed that now. I've gone below the line. Something, you must never do that in life. Go below the line. Oh God, now I'm above the line. It's all right, I know what I'm doing really. This is supposed to say craft occupations. These become attacked by capitalist technology, which produces, if you can read this, the detailed division of labor. The detailed division of labor means working on production lines, that kind of thing. What happens with technological change, Marx says, in a capitalist society, is that work becomes broken down into routinized jobs. Production line is the prime example of that. However, with the further development of technology, Marx thought, this could lead to a third stage of the division of labor, which essentially is automated production. Because once human tasks have become so simplified that they're just doing the same thing all day, why can't you just get a machine to do them, Marx thought. And this is essentially what robotized production and computerized production does in some industrial sectors today. Marx thought in a socialist society, automation would advance much further, and it would be linked to human purposes rather than to the inhuman qualities of the market. Automation, Marx argued, would remove many of the more boring jobs. You could get rid of a large segment of the more boring jobs. To this, within the transformation of division of labour, you would add greater flexibility in work. I mean, Marx only hints at these things, but they seem fairly clear, these hints. Marx thought that the division of labour in a capitalist society is hierarchical. You tend to get hierarchical bureaucracies, for example. You get hierarchies of expertise when doctors and other professionals order you around. It needn't be so, Marx thought. You can have a more flexible division of labour, especially if you've got rid of some of the more bottom-level tasks, by allowing people to move in and out of occupations more freely, to have periods of their life where they wouldn't be dominated by work, and generally by undermining the rule of professional expertise and opening it up to various kinds of questioning by other people. A more flexible division of labour, anyway, is what he had in mind. Now, the reason I mention this is important is that this debate is precisely still with us, and if I get time, I'll talk about it in a subsequent lecture. This debate is now referred to as the end of work debate. We don't really know whether capitalism can produce full employment. It does seem, many writers argue, that modern technology is destroying jobs much faster than demand can be expanded to meet the needs of those who want work. In such a society, it would seem as though work might have much less of a role than it had before. One of the main thinkers involved in this is an ex-Marxist author, French author called André Gortz, living in France anyway. His famous book is called Farewell to the Working Class. Farewell to the Working Class. In which he argues that you should reinterpret Marx strongly along this theme. What counts for us is not so much the socialist organization of labor processes, but abolishing the central role of work in our lives. Gortz argues that modern technology makes it possible for only a minority, small minority of people to be in the labor force and to produce enough for most other people. In such society, he argues, we'll get most of our pleasures, most of our rewards from non-work time. That idea has been linked by many people to the idea of a basic income, by the way. I don't know if you know the literature on basic income, but plenty of people have been suggesting that you should no longer have welfare state benefits. Instead, everybody in a society would get paid a basic citizen's income. And then they would essentially do what they like with their lives. This is sort of a proposal which I believe Gortz also accepted or promoted at one time. Gone off this, can I just put this page back here? That's division of labour. Can I go back to the first point, the abolition of the state, which is equally interesting. You might think, again, here's a utopian proposal, abolish the state. But not so. Marx meant transformation of political power when he talked of abolition of the state. And I think here again he meant two things, really. I think you can interpret Marx as meaning the possibility in a socialist society of much more radical democratization than exists in a capitalistic one on these two dimensions that I now indicate. First of all, in Marx's own time, democracy was a sham, he argued, because it only involved a minority of people. In Marx's own time, you only had the vote if you had a certain amount of property, and of course if you were male. Women didn't have the vote in virtually every Western country until into the 20th century. Marx thought we must generalize democracy to all categories of the population in a socialist society. He didn't anticipate, I think, this would happen within a capitalistic one. Thereby, again, hangs a very interesting tale, I think. Second, and equally interesting, I think, although problematic, Marx argued that liberal democracy, parliamentary democracy, is not only a sham in the sense in which it only involves a few people, it's also a sham in the sense in which it only involves very few aspects of our lives. In a liberal democratic system, Marx argued, what is democracy? Well, it's just the chance to vote every 4 or 5 years for people who are quite remote from you. Moreover, it's only a chance to vote from them in a kind of abstract political domain. It doesn't include some of the core areas of our lives in which we need democracy. the most important core area is our economic activity, the sphere of work itself, Marx thought. In a capitalistic society, the reason unions exist is precisely that there is no industrial democracy, or so Marx could be interpreted as arguing. Unions exist because that's the only form of power and involvement which workers can achieve. In a socialist order, Marx thought, there would be industrial democracy, which would complement political democracy. And he never said much about what this would be, but he did say switch the lights out at 10 to 2 on a Wednesday, because I don't know why the lights gone out. New technology. I mean, all these technologies are crazy, really, aren't they? I must say. Anyhow, if you put these two things together, you get certain ideas which are still around and with us, I think, because as I'll be discussing in subsequent lectures, all the way through the world now, you have on the one hand the triumph of capitalism, yeah, as a global system, not socialism, triumph of capitalism. On the other hand, at this very same time as this system triumphs, it seems to produce enormous problems and difficulties. Thus you have George Soros writing about the limits of market-based individualized capitalism. A system which seems to be triumphant seems to produce at the same time its own inner problems. Second, throughout the world, the same time as liberal democracy is in the ascendancy everywhere, you find liberal democracy under great strain, and you see a renewal of more radical ideas about democratization, including proliferation of referenda, but many forms of more direct and local democracy, including regional devolution, being considered across the world. These are ideas which Marx already had in play, and even while his scenarios proved to be almost utterly wrong, I think, as an account of history, many of the things that he diagnosed as possible within a more humane society still seem to me to be reasonable ways of thinking about how the world might be. Now, just to conclude, what was Marx right about, and what was he wrong about, and what were the reasons for the collapse of communism? Can't say all this in 3 or 4 minutes in the dark, so I'll concentrate for the end of this lecture in just saying what Marx was right about. And just as they always do in good serials, try and get you back next week by at the beginning of the next lecture saying what went wrong with it all and why. It's important, I think, to assert that Marx was right about quite a lot of things, precisely because of the disappearance of Marx himself from history since 1989. I think Marx was right about quite a lot. He was right, unfortunately, I think, much more about the negative characteristics of a capitalist economy and capitalist society than he was about the positive possibilities of its transformation. And thereby, we find our own historical dilemma, I think, at the end of the century. Marx was right to say, I think, for reasons I gave it earlier, that capitalism is an inherently erratic system which cannot stand still. Personally, I think the fact that we live in a world which cannot stand still, where the driving force of change seems to be ever greater all the time, is a major issue for all of us and a major issue for the civilization we have created. Capitalism is a restlessly expanding, voracious system of an erratic kind in just the way, I think, which Marx anticipated. Second, I think Marx was right to say that capitalism is inherently a class system too. That the theme of class comes and goes in the social sciences. You find many people who declare a classless society within capitalism. John Major is not the only one who sort of anticipates using the Marxian term of classless society within a capitalist order. It seems to me, however, that in an era of globalization, we have even a hardening of class divisions, especially class divisions between a sort of globalized cosmopolitan class at the top and large segments of unemployed or semi-employed people near the bottom, whether you call them an underclass or not. There are big forces in the world producing economic polarization, and these forces do seem to be bound up with certain aspects of the capitalistic system, very hard to overcome. They don't lead to class conflicts exactly of the sort which Marx anticipated. I think that what you can say that what's happened in the late 20th century is that the balance between these classes, between capital and labor, has been broken by globalization. Globalization is something we're going to discuss in either the next lecture, no, one or two lectures following from this. You seem to have a tremendous global mobility of capital based upon a global electronic economy which is not matched by an increase in the power of labour, and that seems to lead to polarisation, increasing inequality in many countries across the world. But Marx was right, I think, in diagnosing polarising consequences of this kind of society. Third, I think Marx was also right, at least to some degree, in diagnosing the tendency of a capitalist system to produce monopoly or oligopoly, that is, to produce an economy in which very large corporations play a significant, if not a central, role. Now, we know that the dominance of large corporations is never complete. We know, I think, that it's usually oligopoly production rather than straight monopoly production which tends to exist in any given major sector of industry. We know that small business is much more prominent and much more continuous than Marx anticipated. But nevertheless, the broad scenario seems to be correct. We live in a world in which the large corporations do seem to wield enormous influence in a new globalized economy. Fourth, I think Marx was right, at least to some degree, about the emergence of socialist parties and their implications in the political scene. That is, at least until relatively recently, in most countries, there were class parties. Those class parties tended to be national division between socialist-type parties on the one hand or conservative, liberal-type parties on the other, with many complications. These things did fit fairly well within Marx's scheme. In many respects, I think, therefore, Marx's diagnosis of what capitalism is like was right. Its economic theory, I think, was more or less totally wrong, and that's what partly, in the end, destroyed it. But many aspects of its diagnosis still remain with us and still remain important. If this is true, I'm sorry I haven't stopped for questions, but I promise I will do next time. I just wanted to get through this material. If it's true that what survives in Marx is his critical diagnosis of certain aspects of capitalism, what does not survive, what is dead, as I think it is dead, is socialism and communism, then we're left with a really basic dilemma at the end of the century, I think. That is, who will hear the sigh of the oppressed creature? Who will speak for the heart of a heartless world? I think that the truth of the matter is that we no longer completely know. So I hope to see you next week. Thanks very much. Sorry about the lighting.